IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. We're going to have two Adityas in today's episode. There's me, Aditya Ramanathan, and I'm joined by my fellow Aditya, Aditya Parikh. And my goal here today is to get Parikh to tell us about some rather interesting developments connected to the westernmost fringes of the Indian Ocean, really in the Red Sea. Last month, Russia gave the green light to a draft agreement to set up a naval facility in Port Sudan, which is right on the Red Sea and right next to some of the world's most busiest shipping lanes. Now, just to imagine this on the map, this is right north of the much talked about hub of naval bases in Djibouti. If you recall, Djibouti, which is right on the Horn of Africa, right next to the Horn of Africa, is home to bases from the United States, from France, from China, of course. Even Italy has a facility there, and the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates, for example, have their own facilities there and have, in fact, used those for interventions in next door Yemen. The Bab al-Mandeb, the strait that goes between Yemen on the one side and Djibouti and Eritrea on the other. You know, it's really the strait that connects the Gulf of Aden with the Red Sea. It sits right there. And if you go further north from there, you get Port of Sudan. So some very interesting developments. And I just want to try and unpack this with Aditya Parikh today. So firstly, Aditya, tell us, what do we know about what Russia has actually agreed to? And what are they actually setting up there?
It's great to be here, Aditya, and I'd love to. So Russia, TASS is quoting the draft agreement, and it appears that Russia is leasing the Port Sudan naval base for at least 25 years. And this agreement can be renewed for 10 years indefinitely if both sides are happy with it going forward. More particulars that TASS is quoting are that four Russian vessels can be berthed in the mooring area, including nuclear-powered ones, as long as the environmental aspect is taken care of. There's also this very peculiar sentence I'd like to quote exactly from the TASS report, that it's quoting the draft agreement, that the Sudanese side has the right to use the mooring area upon agreement with the authorized body of the Russian side. So this seems a bit problematic for a state that would like to keep its autonomy and sovereignty absolutely intact. But I guess that's what the agreement has if TASS is quoting it so authoritatively.
Yeah, that's, I guess, not all that untypical for such agreements for bases. We understand what they are trying to set up there, but why are they setting it up over here? Now, one reason is quite obvious. It's right in the middle of these shipping lanes. But is there a specific reason they chose Sudan? And are there other factors at play?
Choosing Sudan in and of itself is not really something that they wanted from the start. I'll come back to this later. But for the moment, let's focus a bit on why Russia always looks for warm water ports, Well, it's the geographical setup that they have, their natural geography, that forces them to do so. So even it has connotations and connections with their ethnic identity connected to their naval fleet. Tsar Pyotr Veliki, Peter the Great, is worshipped in Russia as this ruler that made us great, that distinguished our civilization at an important juncture in our history. So his love for the Russian Navy was something that is still to this day, I wouldn't shrink from saying that, worshipped by the Russian Navy and the Russian people to this day. So outside of the former Soviet sphere, the only place that they have a major naval base in would be Syria and Tarsus. So in Syria. So I think this is a matter of reclaiming some of that lost blue water grandeur by the Russian Navy that the imperial Russian Navy and after that the Soviet Navy had. So I think this is a look to reclaim that greatness.
All right. Now, how does Russia find the money for this, Aditya? Because, you know, this is an economy that is heavily dependent on hydrocarbon imports. And navies are, of course, extremely capital intensive. How do they justify expanding their naval capabilities?
Well, there are certainly many layers to this. So I would say it's more of a political thing than it is cold, hard cash. So, you know, the Russian fleet and the state of readiness and the force levels and the all-out, I would say, effectiveness of the Russian forces bears very heavily on the intactness of the political climate in Russia. I mean, there's no roundabout way to say this, but the survival of the Russian state as we know it depends very heavily on how effective the Russian forces are in securing Russia's interests that are very important to its periphery. So the access to trade can only be secured by a navy that can actually protect the oil shipments, which are very fundamental to the Russian state's finances. So in the Gulf of Aden, for example, in 2010, there was this hijacking of MB Moscow University, an oil tanker, which saw an operation being conducted by Morskaya Pekhota, Russian Marines, against pirates who had seized the vessel. And well, there's even a movie about it called 22 Minutes. So it was a very grave situation. And it was resolved only by military force, protecting Russian nationals on board. So if it's a very important trade sea lane, so they're going to definitely need naval protection there for their merchantmen to pass through.
I just wonder how much spare cash they will have. You know, earlier this year, we had a price war between the Russians and the Saudis. Oil prices plummeted just as the pandemic got started, and you know, you had lockdowns all over the world. There's been something of a rebound now. Oil prices have settled at something like around the $50 mark. We're recording this on 11th December. So maybe they expect to have some spare cash. Maybe they expect to see a sustained rebound in their earnings from hydrocarbons. But Aditya, is there a geopolitical logic to this beyond protecting hydrocarbon trade?
Well, there can be actually a bunch of things if I were to specifically get into it. But, you know, bringing the ethnic identity part back to a bit, I think the Mediterranean is very important to Russia. And this ties back a bit into their competition with Turkey as well. Like, for example, Turkey has a project there for an island called Suakin. So Turkey has a 99-year lease on developing that island and using it. So between Turkey and Sudan. So this place used to be, this island used to be an old Ottoman port city. So this new project for a Russian naval base is also being looked at as a way to counter Turkish influence in Sudan.
Okay, but how do they decide on Sudan then? Is there a logic to that? Or, you know, is it that, I don't know, they couldn't find a more suitable base elsewhere in, you know, around the Gulf of Aden or elsewhere along the Red Sea?
You know, from a very early point after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Russians were looking to expand their capability wherever they could and salvage whatever they could. You know, the Soviet Union used to have Aden in Yemen, Berbera in Somalia, Nokra in Ethiopia. This gave them some power projection capability in MENA, Horn of Africa. And Sudan was never Russia's first choice. They wanted Yemen. But then another civil war broke out there in 2012. After which they tried Djibouti. But as we all know, that didn't work out because the US has more influence in that country. Then they tried Eritrea. Contemplated for a bit, had some meetings, but nothing major came out of it. Then Sudan, previous administration, offered Russia that, yeah, you could come to our country and build a base, which was received very positively. However, Sudan also is in a very stable place. They have a conflict currently with South Sudan. One of the worst humanitarian crises in recent memory happened there. There was even a military coup, after which even still the offer for this naval base stood and Russia just seems to be capitalizing on it.
Right, yeah. You know, Sudan itself is, you know, like you said, it's not all that stable. But, you know, is there a chance that Russia can add some stability to that country, or is that simply out of the question? You know, because you do hear about how dependent, for instance, Sudan is on Russian hardware, so Sudanese military at least.
As far as I know, 80% of Sudan's armory since 2003 is full of Russian hardware. You're correct about that. And I do believe, yeah, Russian forces being stationed there would definitely maybe deter some very bad, some very atrocious human rights abuses that might take place. It might be a positive influence on the country, but that really remains to be seen. But, you know, there's also this angle, the gold mines in Sudan. You know, they're officially, we know this for a fact, this is quite in the open, that the Sudanese government has contracted the Wagner Group. It's a private military corporation, which is allegedly run by Lieutenant General Utkin of the Russian forces and owned allegedly by Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's also known as Putin's chef. So these two alleged confidants of President Putin have a very high say in this matter, I'm assuming, if the allegations are correct.
Yeah, the Wagner Group is quite an interesting entity, right? It's been involved in a lot of the fighting in the Syrian civil war. And in 2018, it was actually involved in a direct firefight with U.S. Special Forces, who then used air power to reportedly kill several members of the Wagner Group. So, yeah, the Wagner Group will, I think, remain quite an important force in East Africa and the Middle East for some time to come. Now, I want to move away from, you know, mercenary groups and bases to, you know, broader sense of Russia's navy and how it sees power projection. You know, typically when we talk about Russia's navy, we say, you know, it's highly split up, right? You have a fleet in the Black Sea, you have another fleet in the Baltic and the Arctic, and then you have another fleet in the East. So this is, you know, Russia's the quintessential land power, you know, and perhaps its navy, like you said, owes its origins to Peter the Great. But at the same time, Russians are investing in expanding their navy despite their economic problems. And they do seem to have some ambitions about their aircraft carrier, the Admiral Kuznetsov. Can you tell us about what is going on with that carrier and how it fits into this broader pattern of Russia's behavior?
Yeah, this is one of those topics that is very close to my heart. So, you know, in general, for the Russian fleet, I would say that like any analyst, I would also have the same opinion that, yeah, it's a bit sub-heavy and their subsurface capabilities, I'd say, are the best in the world when you look at it to cost to pound performance in that way. But carriers obviously are an important part of any fleet, and Russia has historically been not so good with carriers. They have always thought of carriers very literally as aircraft carrying cruiser. So, you know, when you look at Kuznetsov, I'd first like to talk about its negatives. You know, it's an old ship, it's in derelict state, it has had so many accidents. Crane recently crashed through its flight deck and tore through to lower decks and caused damage which to me seemed irreparable. But it seems that the shipyard is already in process of making it whole again. And by 2022, it might be sailing for sea trials. So that's astonishing to me, considering that in that accident, the dry dock that it was on, the carrier, also sank. So, I mean, that's astonishing to me, something that I would say kind of sounds too good to be true. There are also some legacy problems with the ship itself. Like, for example, the boilers on board, which India's aircraft carrier also suffers from the same kind of issues with the boilers. So, there have been reports that the fire bricks used are kind of not up to the mark and causing problems at like 30 knots or so. Similar problems are there for Kuznetsov and Vikramaditya. So that doesn't seem ideal because, you know, a carrier must have at least speed enough to outrun submarines. So yeah, 30 knots doesn't sound very ideal to me if that's the max performance you're getting out of those boilers. Well, when you look at the crazy design of Kuznetsov, the 12 vertical launch tubes right in the center of the flight deck for the P-700 Granit anti-shipping cruise missile, that just seems to me like something that would come out of science fiction. You know, the flight deck has these hatches which open and the jets behind just look at it and the missiles are launched. I mean, that's straight out of some sci-fi movie. But that is a reality that the Russian Navy has operated this platform. And thanks to these launches, you have a platform which is just as lethal, just as capable, even without its air wing. Talking about the air wing, you have the standard loadout of Su-33 multi-role fighters, MiG-29K, which are now being inducted in the Russian Navy as well. Those fixed-wing multi-role platforms in a Stobar configuration. In Stobar configurations, these fighters are taking off on their own power on a ski jump ramp, which is at the end of Kuznetsov's flight deck. This definitely isn't the most ideal configuration for such capable multi-role fighters because it limits the fuel they can carry. It limits the weapons loadout they can carry. So like all Stobar carriers, short takeoff but arrested recovery carriers, where the fighter jets are launched with their own engine power and recovered when they land on the flight deck with three arrestivires. So Stobar configuration does impact a bit on the combat effectiveness of these jets in the carrier's air wing. But yeah, there are other aspects to this platform as well, including the launches that I just talked about for the P-700 Granit. So I guess this crazy ship definitely deserves to be something to be beholden. And as much as people talk about it not having much life left in it, I mean, I would say that life extension refits do take a platform quite a bit. We've seen this with Indian Navy's own Vikrant and Virat carriers. So yeah, I don't really believe that Russia is just yet ready to say goodbye, even after this life extension refit would give Kuznetsov 5 or 6 years in service. No, I don't think that's the end of it. There's going to be more in this ship's lifetime.
Yeah, that's super interesting. You know, for listeners who are just trying to wonder what on earth it looks like to have missile tubes on the deck of an aircraft carrier, just definitely go and Google some photos. It's quite fascinating. Anyway, thanks so much, Aditya. We love having these discussions about the world's navies, and especially when they come and do something in our extended neighborhood around the Indian Ocean. For the readers who are actually interested in the Russian Navy, I would recommend a very recent book. It came out just last year on Admiral Gorshkov. Admiral Gorshkov was an admiral of the fleet of the Soviet Union, the man who really shaped the Soviet Navy and, as a result, the Russian Navy of today. You can definitely check that out if you're interested. We'll also add a link in the description to an article by Samuel Ramani, who has done some fairly interesting analysis of Russia's move to set up a base in the port of Sudan. Once again, thank you, Aditya.
Thank you, Aditya, for having me, and I'd also echo those recommendations, definitely.
And thank you for joining us on All Things Policy.
Please consider signing up for Takshashila's courses. Applications are now open, and you can apply at www.takshashila.org.in/courses.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.